So, we can look at drug addiction as a disease that needs treatment. But we have also learned lots about drug addiction as a model because it's a probe to better understand how the brain works. And in fact, it's even been some better probes than some diseases in psychiatry. And this is how Dr. Dorit Ron has approached the problem of Ibogaine. Knowing Ibogaine's unusual properties, she wanted to use this to further understand what different types of factors, intracellular, etc., and signaling pathways were at the root and mechanism of such an unusual and interesting drug. This is what we're going to hear about today. Dr. Dorit Ron received her PhD in pharmacology at the Hebrew University in Israel, and her postdoctoral fellowship has been both in neurology and molecular pharmacology, first at UCSF and then at Stanford. In 1997, she has since come back to the Ernest Gallo Clinic and Research Center at UCSF, and now she is assistant professor in residence there. It's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Ron.
Thank you, Lori. So first I would like to thank Lori for giving me this opportunity to speak in front of you, and this has been a great session and a very educational session for me. As Lori mentioned, I study alcohol addiction, but from the molecular signaling aspect of it. And we became interested in the Ibogaine research. And our initial aim was to try to identify molecular signaling pathways that may mediate these very important effects of Ibogaine, which you have heard of. But before we started with actually to dissect the molecular mechanism of Ibogaine, we first wanted to see in our hands whether Ibogaine actually works on our animal behavior, on our ethanol-mediated behavior paradigm. And for that, and there was not, except for the study that was mentioned here, there was not a lot known about Ibogaine in animal studies that are associated with alcohol addiction. And for that, I collaborated with a behavior at the Gallo Center, Patricia Janik. And the first thing we did was to basically, in our hands, determine whether Ibogaine will reduce ethanol self-administration. So for that, we use the voluntary ethanol intake. Rats are placed in their home cage, and they have a long period of time to consume relatively high level of ethanol. And as you can see here, when the rats were systemically injected with Ibogaine, there was a significant decrease in their voluntary ethanol intake. And importantly, their preference for ethanol versus water was decreased as well. Importantly, we used another rewarding substrate, sucrose, and importantly, in our study, the intake of sucrose was not altered after systemic injection of Ibogaine. So there was something special about Ibogaine and ethanol in our studies. We went to a more a sophisticated animal testing, and we used the operant self-administration test, which is another test for self-administration, which was introduced to you previously by Zeni Glick. With ethanol, it's actually easier. We have an operant chamber, and the rat is put in the chamber once a day for an hour. There are two levers, an inactive lever and a lever that when the rat actually presses it, so the rat actually has to work for alcohol here, the rat then gets the drink. And I'm not a behavior person, so I'm always very impressed by the fact that rats can actually be trained and actually like to consume ethanol just like people. When rats were trained to self-administer ethanol in this paradigm, as you can see here, this is the number of times the rats pressed the lever. When they were systemically injected with Ibogaine, the number of lever pressing was significantly reduced. And these are just examples of the number of pressing of the lever presses of two different rats before the ibogaine injection, 3 and 22 hours after the injection of the drug. We then went on to test whether two questions. One, whether ibogaine was rewarding or aversive, and whether it changed the rewarding properties of ethanol. So for that we used an animal behavior test called condition place preference, and very briefly, you put in this case mice in a box that contains a middle chamber and then these two chambers that are very different by texture and color. And on the habituation day, the mice can explore both chambers. And then, during the condition period, which takes approximately a week, the mice are injected with a drug of choice, in our case, ethanol, and always in the same chamber, or saline in the different chamber. So the mice are associating the drug with the chamber. And if they like it, then they will associate the drug with the drug. They associated the memory of the drug with this chamber. If they don't like it, they associate the memory with the saline chamber. Then on the test day, they are being put in the middle, and then they can go to either side. They're not giving any drug. And basically, the different score is how long they spend in the drug side versus how long they spend in the saline side. So if the drug is rewarding, they'll spend more time here. If the drug is aversive, they'll spend more time here. And what we found was two things. One, ibogaine was neither aversive nor rewarding. And as you can see here, when the mice were trained and they were injected daily with ibogaine, there was no change in their preference to either side. As you can see here, when the mice were trained to associate one side with ethanol, so ethanol, as you can see here, is rewarding. Before the test day or on the test day, they were injected with ibogaine. Ibogaine did not change the rewarding properties of ethanol. And the last behavior test that I want to show you, it's a very simple test that we call relapse test, and it's actually a very simple test. So again, this is again rats. The rats are trained to press a lever, and they maintain here a baseline of lever pressing. And then you take ethanol away. So when you take ethanol away, they spend a short period of time where they press a lot because they want the ethanol, but then they basically go back to close to baseline, where they basically give up and they learn that they're not going to get the drug. But then, after they reach this baseline, we subject them to different relapse models, such as stress or cue, if this was associated with a cue, or in the example that I will show you here, with ethanol itself. So ethanol can induce relapse. So when we train these animals to consume ethanol, we then take ethanol away and give it back when the lever pressing was close to baseline. What we get here, rats that were injected with saline now start to press the lever a lot. Rats that were injected with ibogaine, you see a very significant decrease in the lever pressing for ethanol. So this is the summary of these series of studies. We were convinced that ibogaine is actually very interesting, and we then went on to try to identify the molecular mechanism that mediating these desirable activities of the drug. Now, from a signaling point of view, and this is very, very basic, and this is more or less the dogma of how we see the development of phenotype or the disease that we call addiction from the signal transduction point of view. So acute exposure to a drug leads to changing in the signaling pathway, and that leads to eventually change in gene expression. This, in some cases, lead to chronic consumption. Now you get also changes in signaling, gene expression, but now you're starting to see synaptic remodeling. This can lead to compulsive drug use. Now there are persistent changes in gene expression, and these are what we call, this is what we call the disease of addiction. Very simple. Because of this very simple model, we wanted to know if ibogaine is changing basically very long-term neuroadaptations that are associated with phenotypes that are associated with drug of abuse. Does ibogaine itself changes gene expression? And to make a very long story short, we found that ibogaine increases the level of a protein called GDNF in the midbrain dopaminergic neurons that include the VTA. Now, you've heard the VTA mentioned a couple of times in this session or in this afternoon. I just want to mention here, we were very excited because the VTA is part of the reward pathway and it is part of the neurocircuitry that mediates ethanol or drug-seeking behavior in general. Now, what is GDNF? GDNF is the glial-derived neurotrophic factor. The name comes from the fact that it was originally identified as a secreted factor from glia, from astrocytes. It works. It belongs to a larger family of growth factor and of neurotrophic factors. But what is important for this talk, it works by activation of a receptor tyrosine kinase called RET and a co-receptor called GFR-alpha-1. Now, GDNF, I don't have time to go too much into it here, it's a very important survival factor for neurons, both in the periphery and in the central nervous system, including the dopaminergic midbrain neurons. But for our purposes, it was very exciting for us. This was a study that was done before our study. The group by Eric Nestler found now 3 years ago that basically GDNF in the VTA reverses the both behavior and biochemical adaptations to cocaine and morphine. So basically what they found was if you give cocaine or morphine, you get behavior changes such as sensitization. If you give ibogaine into the VTA, you reduce sensitization. There are also biochemical changes that GDNF reverses, which I'll mention in a little bit. So putting the two and two together, we went on to ask two questions. Does ibogaine work in the VTA? And does ibogaine work via GDNF? So the first question, Nancy Chen, who is actually here, a postdoc in my lab, did the following experiment. She trained rats in the operant self-administration paradigm, as I explained to you before, but this time she implanted a cannula into the VTA, and after implantation, when the rat resumed their baseline of ethanol intake, she injected ibogaine directly into the VTA, and as you can see, in the VTA, ibogaine was able to decrease the lever pressing for ethanol. And I have to mention here that we observed the same side effects. I have not, but from what I hear, my postdocs have observed the same side effects that were mentioned here, the tremors and the very subjective description of the rats are weird. But when the ibogaine was injected into the VTA, these side effects, the tremors and the strange behavior, actually were not observed, which was actually very encouraging for us. So we get an increase in GDNF in the VTA. We inject ibogaine into the VTA. We see decrease in operant self-administration for ethanol. Can we actually prove, or can we get evidence, I wouldn't say prove, can we get evidence that ibogaine is working in the VTA via GDNF? So for that, we turn into a cell culture model, and I know that for most of you this is going to be a little bit far from what you do, but I hope that I'll be able to with these cartoons explaining what we did. So we used the SHSY5 assays, which is a cell culture model for dopaminergic neurons. And the first thing we wanted to determine whether in our cell culture model we see an increase in the message of GDNF and whether this results in the actually production of the GDNF protein and in its secretion. And the answer is yes. This is the time course of ibogaine increase in GDNF mRNA, and this is the time course for the secretion of GDNF from the media. And as you can see, and this is for cell culture models, this 12 hours is long-term, so our effects are actually quite long-term as well. How does GDNF work? So GDNF binds to its co-receptor GFR-alpha-1. This leads to association of the co-receptor with the receptor. The receptor gets activated by autophosphorylation, and then via recruitment of different adapter and signaling protein, it leads to the basically changes of gene expression or other function that result in the behavior that we see. So we started to determine whether ibogaine actually works on GDNF by addressing different points, and I'm just going to address a couple of points here. So the studies that I'm going to show you here is we asked the question, does ibogaine increase the phosphorylation of the receptor RET? And for that, we did the following experiment. We took cells, control cells, or cells that we treated with ibogaine. We can isolate proteins by an assay that we call immunoprecipitation, basically the binding of a protein to specific antibodies. We can actually isolate this protein from our mixture of proteins, and then we can probe either for the presence of this protein or the presence of the phosphorylated protein with specific phospho-specific antibodies. So when we did this experiment, this is first the immunoprecipitation of just the red protein in the presence of with a time course of a exposure of cells to ibogaine. And when we probe the membrane with phospho-specific antibody, we see after an hour increase in the phosphorylation of RET, and this phosphorylation persisted up to 12 hours. Are these connected? Well, we think they are. We did the following experiments to verify that. So first of all, I want to show you here again the phosphorylation of RET in the presence of ibogaine, or here as a positive control we use GDNF, and you see the increase over the baseline level. But now, when we added, let's put it like this, when we added to the mixture inhibitory antibodies that bind GDNF but prevent it from binding to its receptor, together with ibogaine, now we inhibit ibogaine-induced increase in the phosphorylation of the RET receptor. We then went on to actually determine that ibogaine increased the level of ERK, the phosphorylation level of ERK via GDNF, which I will not show you here. I'll just go directly to function. One of the hallmarks of biochemical changes with prolonged exposure to drugs of abuse, cocaine, morphine, and alcohol as well, is the increased level of a protein called tyrosine hydroxylase, which is the rate-limiting step in dopamine biosynthesis. And we were lucky to be able to basically replicate that in our cell culture model. So what you see here is the increased level in tyrosine hydroxylase, or here, after a 24 hours incubation of cells with ethanol, when we added either GDNF or ibogaine, we saw a decrease in the protein level of tyrosine hydroxylase. And now, if we inhibit the GDNF, either binding to its receptor or by cleaving the receptor from the membrane, and we incubate these two compounds together with ibogaine, we reversed the effect of ibogaine, and the level of tyrosine hydroxylase were high as in ethanol alone. So this is, again, a summary of what I just showed you. How can we take it back to the animal model? So we said the following. if ibogaine increased the level of GDNF in the VTA, and this leads to reduction of ethanol self-administration, then if we block GDNF in the VTA, are we going to then reduce the effects of systemic administration of ibogaine? For that, Nancy Chen in the lab, again implanted the VTA cannula, but now she also added a mini pump in the VTA in which by which she administrates the neutralizing anti-GDNF antibodies that blocked the effect of GDNF as I showed you in the cell culture model. And when she did that, and this was very exciting, as you can see here in the white bar, this is the lever pressing before ibogaine injection. This is the lever pressing after ibogaine injection, 3 hours, 24 hours. But when the anti-GDNF inhibitory antibodies were implanted were given into the mini pump, there was a reduction in the systemic activities of ibogaine on the ethanol self-administration, suggesting the following, that I wouldn't say this is the mechanism of action, but there's definitely evidence that ibogaine, by somehow increasing the level mRNA level of GDNF that results in the increase in the secretion of GDNF, that results in the activation of the GDNF signaling pathway, this leads to the reduction of voluntary ethanol consumption. So I just want to acknowledge with pictures the people that actually did the work. All the molecular cell work were done by Dayao He and Ajay Ravandranan, now at Ray White's lab. Nancy Chen did all the behavior essays, and Ki is a technician in the lab that helped all of them. And the behavior studies were done in collaboration with Patricia Janik, who's also a principal investigator at the Gallo Center. And the funding, of course, I have. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Dr. Ron for taking a very potentially complicated subject and making it quite understandable.